overwhelming number of scientific studies link these population declines to pesticide use. Keep the Hives Alive is a documentary film that shows the use of toxic pesticides are having far-reaching impacts on a wide range of environments, including beehives. Again, that's a film screening at the documentary Keep the Hives Alive, Thursday, August 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at the KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, I'm Ed Melnick. In solidarity with San Francisco's 50-year anniversary of the Summer of Love, I'm inviting you to join me for a 2-hour special Monday sampler on August 7th.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline.
From the 1967 music scene, music from artists like Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, the Beatles, and many others will be featured. Join me for 2 hours to tune in, turn on, and drop out. That's Monday, August 7th, 2 to 4 p.m.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Beloved, the open-air Sacred Art and Music Festival happening Friday, August 11th to Monday the 14th, now celebrating 10 years. Located in an Oregon coastal forest venue about 1 hour west of Corvallis, Beloved Festival weaves together a weekend-long musical story, plus workshops, yoga, craft and food vendors, and camping. Tickets and info at belovedfestival.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we have three amazing women in the studio today here to talk with you about glyphosate and the things that are happening around town locally with glyphosate, as well as sort of the, well, really, it's a global issue of glyphosate toxicity. What is this thing that we talk about? It's better known as Roundup. I think if you're not familiar with the word glyphosate, you probably know Roundup. It is a household name, hopefully not in every
not
household,
in your household
listening, right? So that is what we will be speaking about this morning. And to help us do just that, we have Mimi Castile from Hopewell Vineyard and Hopewell Wines, an organic farmer, and well, all so much about the process of glyphosate in the soil and that kind of stuff going on. Also, we have with us Harriet Cook, who is a physician and has a master's in public health and is very familiar with glyphosate toxicity, and we'll be talking more about that. Also with us, excuse me, this morning is activist Kate Knack, who has started a campaign to end the use of glyphosate around town. So let's get on with it, shall we? Good morning. Thank you all for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, for folks who may have never heard of glyphosate, let's start with...
What is this thing?
What is this amazing chemical?
It really is.
So this and who makes it?
Yes. So this is Mimi, and... Originally, glyphosate was patented as a descaling agent for industrial boilers and pipes in industrial settings. So giant manufacturing companies that had mineral scale built up in their boilers would use glyphosate originally for descaling positively charged minerals. So basically calcium, magnesium, anything associated with a hard water system. But then the patent that we all know about was as a sort of unprecedented herbicide. It's a broad spectrum, so a non-selective herbicide that, especially upon its release, killed very effectively across all plant taxa. But glyphosate molecularly is a very simple amino acid and a phosphonate moiety put together, synthesized in a laboratory. And that is sort of at the heart of its versatility, and it's all of its many myriad implications, both known and unknown. That's the snapshot.
When did it start being used? So Monsanto invented this horrible stuff.
Actually, the original patent for glyphosate was by the Stouffer Chemical Company. The patent for herbicidal activity and also for antibiotic activity. So glyphosate is also patented as a broad-spectrum antibiotic. And those
well,
two
it patents, kills everything, it, so
it's very
I
effective.
Guess it could, yes.
It is very effective in the single-celled organisms especially, but those two patents were held by Monsanto. And in very recent history, those patents have expired. And so now, I mean, there's a glyphosate formulation from almost every major chemical company that operates, certainly within the United States.
Holy mackerel. So when did you first get involved in? You're an organic farm. So mm-hmm. Is your vineyard organic?
Yes, it is.
Ooh, fun. And how did you first get involved with all this and start knowing about the wonders of glyphosate?
Right. My career before coming back to farming was with the U.S. Forest Service. I was a botanist for the Forest Service. And one of the things, when you're in that research community, there's lots of downtime when you can't get into the far back country, and there are lots of times when you're doing make work, and in the Forest Service especially, there's a lot of invasive weed control, and one of my first. I guess moments with glyphosate was when they handed me a backpack sprayer and said, this stuff is biodegradable, it's totally safe, and it's really effective against blackberries and poison oak and things that they wanted to eradicate.
Nothing can be safe that works for blackberries.
So well, yeah, exactly. Anybody who's
ever... If anyone
ever,
tells you that, yeah.
Except me.
Except you?
Right. Yeah, I like to dig up the root, the crowns.
The corns.
Okay, well that's different, but as far as spraying something on...
Yes.
I don't see that anything has ever said that would be the key right there for me.
Correct. And I always like to point out that nobody needs a magic wand more than a farmer or a public land manager. And so I do try to approach this subject from a point of empathy and sympathy, because I don't think anybody who uses glyphosate on their farm or in their public land management really knows the basis for its chronic toxicity. There is a tremendous amount of ignorance and naivete about glyphosate, and that has everything to do with how it's been marketed.
Of course.
These chemistries were born from a desire to make dollars. And so the people who have borne the brunt of the devastation of glyphosate are the people who were least able to know how it operates in the world.
And let's talk a little bit more about, beyond the glyphosate toxicity, there's also a concern around glyphosate and pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, listeners to our show, we've talked about pollinators before. We need them.
Who are they?
The world needs them. Excuse me. The food supplies need them. Bees, butterflies, you know, the insects that actually help us grow food and feed the world. How are they affected by glyphosates?
Well, I'm sure Harriet and Kay might want to weigh in on this as well. But for me, the most simple explanation is that bees and all pollinators also have a very symbiotic relationship with the microbial community that colonizes their guts and pretty much their entire bodies. And since glyphosate targets a pathway that is common to all microorganisms with very few exceptions, but especially the beneficial microorganisms that say in a bee's gut helps them, you know, get the nutrition that they need from the food that they eat, but then also the very powerful enzymes that regulate their ability to find their nest, to find their hives, those things are disrupted at tiny amounts of glyphosate. I mean, far less than field application rates. And furthermore, when those things interact with other chemistries that are commonly applied, there is an almost devastating effect on a bee. But in terms of a kind of chronic activity of glyphosate on bees especially, it has a lot to do with the microorganisms. And I think that's the way this really crept up on us, is that we didn't see the damage until the damage was done.
Harriet or Kay, anything more to add to that?
Well, this isn't something specifically that I've studied, but I do know that there's a variety of bees, and our native bees include ground-dwelling mm-hmm. bees. And the irony that Kay and I are experiencing is glyphosate has been used to help eradicate quote-unquote invasive weeds in our neighborhood park in order to create a pollinator project. So they're spraying this toxin to kill all the weeds, and of course it goes into the soil. Now I can bet you that they have not done soil testing. What I understand about glyphosate is that depending upon the soil, it can be broken down fairly quickly, or it can stay for one of the things that I read, they did soil testing, and 6 months after application it had the same prevalence as right after the application. And when you repeatedly use glyphosate on soil, it builds up and it breaks down less frequently, probably because it's killing the microorganisms that help to break it down. So the more you kill off the microorganisms, the more it stays in the environment.
Right.
And so they want to create space for these ground-dwelling bees. Now you've got poison ground that's got residue of this chemical that it
makes no sense.
It makes no sense unless you don't understand the whole picture.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little about the health effects. So Harriet, as a trained physician looking at this issue, you have experienced health problems yourself.
Yes.
From glyphosate.
Well,
and other things, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. When you have chronic problems, you don't exactly know what causes it. There are so many contributing factors to chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and brain fog and memory issues. And so you do your best to, you know, figure it all out.
Right, right. What are you finding in, you know, when you started looking into some of those issues around glyphosate toxicity?
Okay, so one of the things that I noticed, let's talk about gluten, because we know that there's this epidemic of gluten sensitivity.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the time that my body told me, stop eating gluten. I was chewing a piece of bread and it felt like my cheek had just run a marathon. And it's like, okay, time to stop eating bread. I, like most people, like pizza and, you know, pasta.
And you know, and those gluten-free crusts just don't do it.
No.
I think it's, you know, it's part of the, it's, you have to have a really hot oven and, yeah. But it's like, yeah, I have.
That's a whole nother thing.
It's a whole nother thing, but.
Yes. You don't want to be gluten-free. That is not something that you say, I want to join this gluten-free fan club.
Right.
It's something that you give up, you know, because you have to give it up because you want your brain to function. You want to be able to be...
A healthy person.
You want to be able to think clearly and have the energy to follow through
and
with
digest
things.
Food. Digest your food. Yes.
Yes.
Things like that.
Yes. And we won't go into my digestive history. but when... When I read about the ways that glyphosate hit the gut, so there were two to three ways. One of them is it affects the bacteria in the gut, and I need to look into the research. But apparently, it's selective for the more beneficial bacteria. So we have a balance inside our gut between beneficial and pathogenic. Bacteria. And we know in medicine that certain antibiotics are good for certain bugs, which is why your doctor will do a culture and a sensitivity, because it just happens that glyphosate targets beneficial bacteria, which allows the pathogens to grow. So then you have this imbalance, you have chronic inflammation in the gut.
And you cannot be healthy if you have that.
You cannot be healthy. There's something called leaky gut syndrome.
Ah, yes.
So in order to be healthy, the cells in the intestine need to be tight next to each other. And that prevents large molecules and proteins from moving from the gut into the bloodstream. Because in the body, if you have these larger molecules and proteins, your body sees that as a foreign substance, and there is an immune response. And so you end up with inflammatory reactions, autoimmune problems, and brain fog, and mental health issues. This is probably a piece of the problem of the epidemic of mental health problems that are going on. So we have the bacteria imbalance that's going on, but there's something direct also with the glyphosate that causes a shrinkage of the cells so that the space between the cells gets wider and these large molecules can come through. So there's two ways that you get leaky gut. One is by the cell shrinking and the space expanding, and the other is apparently it punches holes in the gut. And Mimi shaking her head, we'll let her talk a little bit more about the hole punching.
It takes anywhere from 10 to 100 times, 100-fold the amount of glyphosate to kill the pathogenic organisms in our microbiome than it does to kill the beneficial organisms that are keeping those bad guys in check. And that alone can cause inflammation and loosen those tight junctions in your enteric nervous system. So your stomach is supposed to be able to communicate with your brain through the vagus nerve. But furthermore, it's supposed to regulate the transfer of nutrients, just as Harriet was saying, allowing good nutrients to enter your bloodstream so that they can feed your body, and keeping out bad things like large molecules or proteins. And it can, so starting with inflammation, those tight junctions can loosen. And then furthermore, the negative bacteria that will then fill the negative space created by the die-off of the beneficial microorganisms, those can create even more inflammation and start producing their own hormones that further disrupt the communication between your enteric nervous system and your brain. The blood-brain barrier is very, very powerful, but the gut-blood-brain barrier has to allow things through, and so that is a very direct effect of how glyphosate is causing pathways to modern diseases that were really never seen before. I mean, the molecule of gluten looks very much in your bloodstream like a thyroid molecule. And so just as Harriet was saying, once a molecule of gluten, so a proteinaceous molecule entering your bloodstream that's fairly large, your immune system, your white blood cells, will immediately go on alert and look at that molecule of gluten and say, I don't like you. And that's when your gluten sensitivity starts. But then once it gets used to identifying gluten as an enemy in your bloodstream, it then also looks at your thyroid molecules and says, I don't like the looks of you either. And that's when you get things like Hashimoto's expression of gut dysbiosis and gluten sensitivity, chronic gut dysbiosis.
And we are seeing so much more of this. I mean, as you're talking about this, and I'm feeling so amazingly more informed, and I try to keep up on it, but we're seeing so much more of this sort of thing all the time.
Yes.
And inflammation, is it not, is the beginning. All disease comes from inflammation at some,
you have to be careful with the word all, inflammation is right up there with, you know, one of those, you know, fundamental problems. In functional medicine, they talk about, you know, certain systems of illness, and inflammation is one of the causes of illness, and there's a lot of different, you know, things that cause inflammation, but you know, nutritional deficiencies is another one of those systems-wide aspects that cause illness. Nutritional deficiencies are also caused by glyphosate toxicity, because glyphosate will, there's two ways that I'm aware of. One is it chelates metal, so that we need certain kinds of metals and minerals. Glyphosate will chelate those so that we're not able to absorb them. It also does that in the soil, and so the crops, the food that we eat, doesn't have the mineral content that we need. So we have nutritional deficiency. So that's another aspect of functional medicine that causes illness.
And if we get back to what Mimi was initially saying about the development of glyphosate in the first place, which is an industrial descaler, getting minerals out, you can see that there's like a direct correlation, right, between how it interacts with minerals. And all right, that light bulb just went off in my head. That's cool. So all this is happening. Glyphosate is ubiquitous. We've seen articles in the last week about how it's being found in Ben and Jerry's ice cream and it's
mother's milk.
Yes, for example. You know, it is everywhere, and there is currently it's being used or is planned to be used in Portland Parks and K as the community organizer. Being used, okay. Kay is the community organizer. You want to talk about what's happening right now with the Portland Parks and spraying and glyphosates.
Okay.
Update us.
Well, thanks and a big up to KBOO and Ani and Lynn. Positively revolting. It's really a blessing to be able to put the word out today about this issue right in our backyard. So many in Portland know Gabriel Park to be quite a jewel that we all enjoy. And there's a certain expectation of safety there. Portland Parks has always been lauded for their integrated pest management program as being salmon safe and one of a leader in that kind of environmental stewardship. So I've been a community gardener at Gabriel Park for 17 years, and I have a deep connection to the land as an herbalist, mother, and someone who really respects Mother Earth and likes to share that with others. I've been gardening organically for over 45 years. So we always had this little field across from our community orchard, which serves many people with the Oregon Food Bank, Portland Fruit Tree Project. Our organic community garden is one of the oldest in the city. We participate in Produce for People with Neighborhood House, and we also have the Amazing Sprouts Academy, which is a pre-K and summer camp program for children that is nature-based. So they have their run of the place. So up where the garden is a wonderful place. It's like a quilt that includes the garden, the orchard, and then goes down into the riparian zone. This is a most special place because it's possibly the most intact riparian zone now in Gabriel Park. And everyone should realize that this place is also special because Multnomah Village itself holds the headwaters that flow into Fano Creek and Tryon Creek. So the field was always an unmanaged field, it would be called. To us, it was a nice open space. It was a mixed, diverse mix of grasses and herbs, and it would be mowed a few times a year. We had lots of pollinators. I would go there every spring and gather my herbs for my fresh salves, and also forage the amaranth, lamb's quarter, purslane, chickweed. I'd gather my red clover, yarrow, wild carrot, cedar, etc. So it was nice. And in 2015, as part of the Gabriel Park Southern Expansion Plan, a pollinator meadow concept was presented to gardeners. And we thought it was a great idea because who doesn't want more pollinators? We have lots in our organic garden.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Makes sense on the surface, as they say.
Yeah. So we got a little questionnaire and, you know, what do you think about this? Yes, yes. So then shortly after that, we all wanted to help, and we thought we'd just be going over there and adding more plants for pollinators. So shortly after that, a sign went up, and then it said that it was going to be a process, and there would be selective removal of non-native invasive plants as they prepared the site. So we didn't see much going on. And then I started to smell herbicides. And this was in the conversion, so-called, started in late 2015. And then by 2016, because I always look at that field, that's one of my spots that I love. And I start to notice that the plants, they look dead and they shouldn't be looking dead. And then one day I smelled herbicide over there. And then one day I finally saw somebody working. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, well, we just selectively remove the non-native invasive plants." I said, "What are you spraying?" He said, glyphosate. But they call it Ranger Pro 2, and they also use Vastlan. And Mimi can speak more about the increased toxicity with the inerts and the surfactants that are used. So then I started to really investigate, because this isn't my first run-in with glyphosate. In 96, when they started using glyphosate for more than pre-emergent needs and started, as Mimi was saying, on just broadcasting it on plants and even right before harvest so that everything would be ripe at the same time and it served to dry things out. So, you know, I've been doing some research too because I'm an herbalist and I've always, like I said, I'm organics, I'm a nature girl. You know, this is what we need to be doing for the future generations. This is our real work. We got to be working on leaving a better world. So anyway, a lot of uncomfortable conversations with Parks. I realized then,
nicely put,
that
uncomfortable
the field has been sprayed 4 to 5 times a year with glyphosate, and I quickly saw that what is emerging after each spray in the field is more and more what is known as resistant weeds. But I know that Mimi actually understands what that resistance is more about. This last time in June, I knew that, to me, it looked like the field was lost of control. It was nothing but what they call the Palmer amaranth or pigweed, which is famous as being glyphosate resistant, and another plant called willow herb, full of it. You couldn't see any of those other herbs, and it was 3 and 4 and 5 feet high. It took, despite my pleas to postpone that I could get a crew together to pull weeds, and I had offered that other times, I was told that I needed to understand that the spray was going to happen and that this was going to be completed. And as it stands now, we face another spray in 6 weeks. And that's why the urgency of getting the word out.
Who do people need to contact, and how can they do it?
Well, we're having a meeting with Parks on Monday at 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Southwest Community Center, which is at the corner of Southwest 45th Avenue and Southwest Vermont. On July 6th, that 1.2-acre meadow, which drains like a chute into the riparian zone on a 30% slope and goes directly down to the creek that houses a spring which feeds into Vermont Creek and then into Fano, then into Tualatin. That field was sprayed for 3 hours with glyphosate by three sprayers just walking in a horizontal line going from top to bottom, and everything in that field except a few poor native trees that had been put in, everything was killed in that field except for what is now resistant and blowing seed.
All right. I want to invite our listeners to come on in and join us this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. There are things that we can do about this, and that's another thing we want to bring into the conversation. We don't just have to sit back and watch these sprays happen. There's organizing efforts to this effect, hence the three of you coming on the show this morning.
The three being Kanak, Harriet Cook, and Mimi Castile. We thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lynn, for the re-ID. That's always good. You can also like us on Facebook. You can like Positively Revolting. We post articles like, about all of the things that we talk about, as well as some positive things happening that you can be a part of as well. We post to that page, well, all week long, because once a week getting together, it's just not enough to save the world. You can also follow along on Twitter. And Twitter, you can find us at Positive Revolt. We had a caller already who didn't want to stay on the line but wanted to throw in a quick question. I think, Harriet, I think this one's for you. A caller wants to know if both highly processed gluten and natural gluten are problematic. Is there a difference that people are finding between the high gluten, highly processed gluten, and plain old regular gluten?
Okay, so the word natural means absolutely nothing. So if you see that word, just ignore it.
Understand, it's a marketing technique and not actually a description.
One of the things that Mimi mentioned and Kay, in addition to killing off weeds and making the soil more toxic, they spray glyphosate on fields in order to hasten the ripening if they think it's going to rain, grains in particular. And so if you have gluten comes from wheat, and you don't know whether or not that wheat was sprayed 10 to 14 days before harvesting, and that glyphosate gets into the wheat. You can't wash wheat anyway, but even things that you can wash off, it becomes internalized into the food. And so there's glyphosate residues, and you don't know what has glyphosate residues and what doesn't have glyphosate residues. And this builds up in the system. The higher the exposure, the more that it builds up in the body, and over time it builds up because there's more of it that we're exposed to. It's so prevalent that one of the articles that I read said that they find it even in organic free-range eggs. Why? It's in the water, it's in the soil. It's just all what we can do is minimize our exposure. And the more that we minimize exposure, the more that our bodies can handle the bits that we have. We do have detoxifying pathways in our bodies. Some people have stronger detoxification pathways than others. I'm one of those others. You know, we've got the genetic testing now. We can tell if we have some of the mutations in the enzymes that help us to, the short story is, create neurotransmitters and detoxify substances. Well, if you're one of those people who has marginal amounts, a little bit of a toxin is going to have a big effect on your health. Whereas if you're somebody who has more robust amounts of those enzymes, it'll take a bigger hit. You can handle more of these toxic substances before you get sick. But we're all going to get sick at a certain level. So, what was the question?
Gluten, highly processed or natural? And
gluten.
I would say in the first sentence.
Yeah, organic.
Yes,
organic. If you're gonna have wheat, make sure it's organic because there's less chance of there being glyphosate in there. And yeah, so that's the bottom line.
Excellent.
So Brian's holding.
Let's
Shall
do
we,
that.
Let the Brian. Good morning.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Well, that was quick. yeah, this is an interesting topic for me. I'm an organic farmer, and I'm apparently gluten sensitive. And I saw my doctor. I've been, you know, even though I eat really well, I've been having issues. And I have gotten, like so many people, you know, it's a cultural thing. I'm sure they've had a episode of Portlandia about gluten intolerance, you know, where you're made to feel like a whining baby if you have a problem with gluten. And so I got to the point where I was like, you know, God, I'm just tired of dealing with this. Everything good has got gluten in it, and maybe I just don't need to be so picky about it. And my doctor said, no, you do. You really do. And one of the things that people may not realize, I, like a lot of people, probably thought, well, I did think that I'll just minimize my consumption of these things, and that way it won't affect me as much. And if I'm out and about and that's all there is to eat, I'll just do it because that's what's there. And then the doctor said, no, exposure to any of it for some people will affect you. So if you've got any, it's going to affect you like you had, I guess, a lot. So that's something to bring up. And another thing about the glyphosate, I've been anti-glyphosate for years. You know, even farmers and extension agents would recommend like glyphosates in situations of minimal till or no-till situations. Mm-hmm. And so that seems like a really environmentally friendly concept. But I've been, for years, just my gut said that it's not right.
Even in so many ways,
huh? It breaks down quickly and everything. And now it's so interesting to hear all this information that, well, it turns out, once again, it's one of those turns out situations. And this is really interesting. And one last thing, as a farmer, organic farmer, it's so much hard work. It's so hard to do right by the soil. It takes so much work. And I will, day after day, just to squeak by a living, do all the things that I know I should do for the soil. And then I look at my neighbor who's got a few weeds growing by his driveway, running up and down his driveway with glyphosate. Mm-hmm. And it just points to this constant striving for more convenience. And even farmers like us in this hotbed of organic activity in Portland still struggle to make a living because people demand ultimate convenience in everything. And the glyphosate is just one of those examples of, you know, that convenience kills.
And what's the matter with a few weeds?
I just don't get it.
You
know, too many weeds takes sunlight, nutrients, and water from the plants you're trying to grow.
Okay.
But a few weeds shows that you're doing it right.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Excellent.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. And just remember to source your food very carefully and go local.
Yeah.
And also go local with farmers that may not be organic yet, because if they go out of business, you can't do anything about it. But if you can support them and encourage them in that direction, then that makes a difference too.
Thank you. Everyone is nodding
totally
their head.
Totally concur.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
And Kay, did you have something to add?
Oh, just bigging up the organic farmers out there. And you know, the big thing about that is our food is just a byproduct. What we're really doing is building living soil. And by doing that and then consuming and giving back to the earth, it's that
web of
life.
Do you remember that book 100 years ago, The Secret Life of the Soil?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that totally, and I can't remember, I should be a good host and have the person that wrote that, but that I've realized that from then on, whenever you grow things, it's the soils.
Yeah.
Stupid, he used to say. But it's it all comes from having soil that works. You can't have plants that grow.
Peter Tompkins.
Peter Tompkins. Thank you, Peter Tompkins, for The Secret Life of the Soil.
It's a screen in front of me. I can.
I know you did that well.
Just
thank
like
you.
That.
And it's a great read.
All right. Let's go ahead and talk to David, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, ladies. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well.
Good, good. Hey, great show. I'm really grateful for programs that come on the air and talk about stuff like this.
Would you turn your radio down, David?
Yeah, hang on.
I mean, Brian.
Sorry.
No, this is David. Sorry.
This is David.
I'm looking at the David, thank you.
No worries. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Sorry about that.
No worries.
So, I too am a long-time organic gardener. I live down in the Springfield area, and when my wife and I purchased the home with the land that came with it, we got about a third of an acre, and we immediately converted the entire back corner of it to a chicken farm. So we've got chickens running around. They all get organically sourced scratch and feed and those kinds of things from the store in Eugene. We also ripped up most of the lawn that had been left behind and replaced it with flowers and seeds that are native to Willamette Valley. And that really added a lot of color and a lot of depth to the garden, because we've noticed since I've established our vegetable garden this spring, we've had a lot of pollinating insects and beneficial insects return to the yard, which has really been wonderful.
It's a good sign.
Yeah, it's a very good sign. Yeah, before I get into the reason why I actually called, I just wanted to say to the previous caller, Brian, when I have a philosophy about people who spend too much time trying to keep their yard sanitized of weeds, I think it's an early sign of narcissism. But that's just my theory.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
It's a sign of narcissism, but that's just a psychological theory. Anyway. The reason I called was because earlier you addressed actually the question that I had called in earlier regarding gluten, the effects of gluten on processed flour, and I felt compelled to clarify what my question really was about. How do the effects of gluten affect people with gluten intolerances when you compare processed flour to grinding whole grains as needed from organic whole grains, which is what I do.
Okay.
Harriet's ready to answer that question. Yeah. Is there a noticeable difference in the two? And does the grinding of organic flour on an as needed basis make a difference to someone who is gluten intolerant?
So if you are gluten intolerant because you have leaky gut syndrome, even the best, most organic gluten, wheat, ground with love and care is going to not do well in your body. So you have to heal the gut before you can reintroduce things like gluten. And sometimes, like, the body gets sensitized, it has a memory. And if you have been exposed to gluten and it's caused this inflammatory reaction and this immunological assault, you know, allergies, asthma, brain fog, whatever. There's a lot of different ways that it's expressed in the body. Your body may still react to gluten even after you've healed the gut, because we have immunologic sensors in the gut that respond and recognize. And so, however, there are some people who, after you've healed the gut, after a period of time, you can reintroduce small amounts of organic wheat and gluten and see how you do. But because we have such a huge burden of glyphosate in our environment, it's in our foods, and we may not be able to get to that place, some of us, until we take care of the glyphosate burden in the larger environment. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, no, it does make sense. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Thank you.
So before we get much further, I want to talk about organizing efforts to end glyphosate spraying, especially in public places in Portland. What's going on to that end? And I'm going to throw this over to Kay.
Okay.
Because after all, I think that might be your piece of this puzzle. I think all of you have several pieces of this puzzle.
Well, the truth is we're all in it together.
There you are.
Because it's the web of life, you know. So it's like, okay, well, what can we do? Because we don't have to invent the wheel here. And other communities, even I was talking with Carrie Rappold down in Wilsonville, and Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides just partnered with them to do a pollinator meadow entirely without any kind of chemicals. So there are models to work with, and right now we're reaching out to work with people who might be interested in helping us to educate ourselves, each other, at parks, and farmers, all those who actually have responsibilities of stewardship with the land, to update the science first. Because what I've found is people who use glyphosate a lot of times, and I would say in parks, are relying on some old science. A lot has come out in the last 2 years, and that's why I was so fortunate to meet up with Mimi, because
she has the science down.
Yeah, and it's really important, yeah. And I do want her to spend a little more time with that, because she can really educate what is it actually doing in the soil and stuff.
So, Kay, so, how can people get together?
Yeah.
So what do you have like a...
So we're just starting our media campaign with this, and we also got a letter to the editor in the Southwest Post. Take a look at that. You'll see you can contact Kendra Peterson Morgan at Parks. She's our contact. Also Amanda Fritz, who is head of Parks, and voice your concern. You know, herbicides just started to be used to this extent in natural areas, I would say, within the last 5 years. We never used to have herbicide spraying up in our area in Gabriel Park. And because of staffing and the perceived cheapness and cost effectiveness, it's being used more to manage natural areas. So anyway, we're starting a Facebook page. Follow us. It's Friends of Gabriel Park Organic Community Garden. And it is brand new. There's nothing up there. So today put a picture up, and I'll note that we were here, and hopefully we'll link to the show later.
Absolutely, because you'll have the audio for the show.
And Mimi's TED Talks. I think she's doing something else.
Repeat the meeting on Monday.
Yes, and the meeting on Monday, August 7th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Southwest Community Center, the corner of Southwest 45th and Vermont. And I might add, come early, look it on your GPS, come up to the garden and take a little look at what we're talking about. I hope we never see this image again, where we see our gorgeous, just bursting with color, life, and pollinators, organic garden and orchard laden with fruit. And then right 25 feet across the road, a totally burned out chemotherapy to death field, you know?
Yeah, you know, this
so
whole...
The image is striking.
The whole deal of managing nature, to me, it's like managed forests are unnecessary because they can manage themselves. And I do believe... other areas can. Nature is perfectly capable of managing itself.
Yeah,
Harriet.
Yeah, I, there are times when we can assist nature in working with her.
That's not managing.
That's not managing, but it is working with her to optimize the soil and the soil depth.
That we have destroyed in the first place.
That we've, right. And this is a piece of the climate change solution as well. Kristen Olson has her book, The Soil Will Save Us, which gives a really nice overview. And Paul Hawkins' new book, Drawdown, Comprehensive Plan for Reversing Climate Change. And many of the solutions involve increasing the carbon in the soil. So... I forgot where I was going with all that.
That's all right. We were managing or not managing, but
managing. Right. So one of the things that I proposed to the park, which we'd have to test the soil to make sure it's safe, you know, and it'll take a while before this glyphosate gets out of there, is why don't you bring a sheep and a goat and let them munch on the, they've shown that in rangelands that the invasive species,
quote unquote, yeah, well, they are invasive, but they
will decrease, and the native species will increase when you have a well managed with the right amount of livestock that is rotated and so forth. There is a way of managing, I guess that's the point I was trying to
goats
make.
Goats love kudzu, yeah.
Yeah, there is a way of managing and working with nature in a natural way to restore the land.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you.
Can I bring up like a...
Of course, Kate. Get closer to your microphone.
Something that comes to mind is just this attitude of the war on invasives and just kind of... asking people to just sit with that and what does that mean, you know? And as an herbalist, you know, the weeds, a lot of those are our greatest medicines. And there's great value in just having these plant communities. They have their instructions too, you know, and we're all part of it. And part of that is just stepping back and watch, you know, look and listen. What is nature trying to teach us right now? So, you know, we have a lot of ways of dealing with the weeds, and we do it all the time, and I'm sure Mimi does too in the vineyards. You know, we use mulching, we use green manure crops, we use timing, you know, we use prayer. You know, we work with nature. And maybe it's wool managing. I don't know.
Wool managing. I like that.
A hundred years ago in Findhorn, a community that was sort of spirit-based.
Very inspiring.
And they would give the insects, here, have this cabbage, like very intentionally, this one. And if bugs are going to a certain piece of, it's because it's not healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so here, have this one. But anyway, I digress, and we have callers.
Yeah, let's go ahead, and I do want to talk to Edie, who has been very patient. Good morning, Edie. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can.
I have a friend from Montana who 20, 30 years ago said that, I remember the time, that they were telling all the wheat farmers, we've got this incredible new crop that is going to be so fantastic. It has 40 to 45 times more gluten in the wheat, and it's going to, you know, make more sales because it makes people kind of more addicted to eating the products made from this flour. And then they got the point that, and they wouldn't answer any questions about why would we want to change something when people have been eating wheat for a long time and had the horrible diseases like the stories about the vampires from a gluten disease, wheat rust. So why would we want to mess around with something that has, when you mess around with wheat, you get serious problems? And they said, oh, no, this is all safe. They couldn't prove what it was safe, what it was about. And then it got to the point that it was impossible to find any wheat that you could use in commercial purposes that did not have this increased gluten in the wheat seed.
I don't know, Emily? Oh, not Emily. I am.
My name's Brian.
And I'm
speaking
David.
Speaking of brain fog, the lovely Mimi.
Mimi.
Yes, the the changing in our cropping systems, especially for cereal based crops, has really been ground changing, life altering in the last 20 years. I mean, the shift
changing in both senses of the word,
precisely. And the new regime with Roundup Ready and herbicide ready crops has really, it has introduced a new reality for the American food system that I think none of us are prepared to assign to our children and grandchildren, anybody who's really paying attention. And to your point, the new cultivars of wheat, especially the ones that are herbicide ready, are genetically modified. And that modification process in and of itself has severe implications, because one of the things that always baffles me about the science behind genetic modification is that it basically goes all the way back to Mendelian genetics, which had this idea that one gene equals one traits. But we know now, I mean, the whole revelation of the double helix is that genes are in a spatial relationship to one another, and you can't affect one without affecting many. And usually when you are genetically modifying a, say, a strain of wheat to have herbicide resistance, if you are, say, you're only inserting four base pairs, in that process of inserting four base pairs, you can turn off thousands, literally. And those are thousands that perform a multitude of other functions in a plant, control hormonal pathways, etc., and can also be the source of starting the synthesis of new proteins that our bodies have never dealt with before. And, you know, I mean, I think just to clarify some things about glyphosate that I think are just generally misunderstood is that glyphosate is a systemic chemical. That's right on the label. Nobody debates that it's a systemic chemical. And if it is being sprayed more than one time, and in most cases more than three times on a cereal crop, there's nothing in a plant that detoxifies that. There's nothing in a plant that actually processes it. It remains in the plant and accumulates in the plant, and the points of accumulation are the meristematic and the reproductive tissue. And for us, that's the food part. We eat the reproductive tissue. So the accumulation point being the reproductive tissue presents that, I mean, just the excessive amount of glyphosate that will be now in our food system compared to when it didn't used to be sprayed in a broadcast manner on all of our cereal crops. It doesn't take a genius to look at the last 25
apparently
years.
Apparently it does. Yeah. But
well, these are correlations to chronic toxicity. And if we were dealing with something acutely toxic, like with DDT, that was a fairly immediate acute toxicity issue that the public could get their heads around. But this product has been manufactured and sold as something that is safe to humans because we lack the enzymatic pathway that it targets. But that enzymatic pathway is the pathway by which we get three essential aromatic amino acids that absolutely cannot be gotten by humans in any other way. Furthermore, there's all the dangers to our entire gut and the beneficial guts that make the digestion of our food possible. We, as a human being, you have no hope of digesting food without your gut microbes.
So we have 1 minute left. So to connect people with your group and what you're doing, again, how can people do that? How can people connect in, and what's coming up on Monday?
Okay, so Monday from 6 to 7:30 p.m., join us, the Organic Community Gardeners of Gabriel Park. There will also be some people who enjoy using the park. Anyone who cares about this, come to Southwest Community Center, Southwest 45th and Vermont, 6 to 7:30, Monday the 7th. Also, go to Facebook and like us, Friends of Gabriel Park Organic Community Garden.
Bless. And it sounds like, Mimi Castillo, you have a TED Talk.
Yes, if you go to the live website, which is livecertified.org, there is a link to my presentation that I give to viticulturists primarily, but there will also be one that I did for Kay's group. That we'll post soon on YouTube.
Excellent. Thank you.
Stay tuned to KBOO all day long. I want to thank all of you fabulous women for joining us at 9 o'clock Pacific Underground, a conversation about sustainable activism, fighting fascism, and life in Portland with Direct Action Alliance. And oh, so much more. 11 o'clock Radio Geekly is up with the most recent Portland Zine Symposium. So much more. Stay tuned to KBOO all day long.
Positively revolting. Ooh. Oh my gosh.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church in Portland. Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories will be performed by Melissa Bangs, who studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade. This is her one-woman comedy show about postpartum psychosis and healing through shared moments, laughter, and tears. Again, that's Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Coon Rin's Electric Fin Band, Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Owl Social Club in Portland. Coon Rin's Electric Fin Band and 1939 Ensemble perform Thai Psychedelia and are part of the Pickathon-sponsored White Owl Social Club's Outdoor Summer Concert Series. Again, that's the Coon Rin's Electric Fin Band and 1939 Ensemble on Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at White Owl Social Club, 1305 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock a.m. Coming up next, it's Pacific Underground. And I am privileged, honored, as well as contractually obligated to remind you that this program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Beloved, the open-air sacred art and music festival happening Friday, August 11th to Monday the 14th.